This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. One primary election is over in Washington, and it's on to the finale, the general election in November. We've reported about the tight race in Washington's 5th Congressional District between Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris-Rodgers and her Democratic challenger, Lisa Brown. Coming into today, McMorris-Rodgers leads by a point, up just a bit from Tuesday night. That's certainly tighter than political watchers expected, and tighter than a poll last spring that showed McMorris-Rodgers up by about 4 points. The two campaigns are already talking about debates, with McMorris-Rodgers saying she has accepted invitations for 2 debates in Spokane and 1 in Walla Walla, and urging Brown to participate in those same debates. Brown's camp countered that she had already accepted the 2 Spokane dates and is awaiting a formal invitation from Walla Walla, and urged McMorris-Rodgers to attend at least 3 more debates to which Brown has accepted invitations. Also at the federal level, U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell cruised through a primary election with 29 candidates. Her Republican opponent will be Susan Hutchison, former chair of the Washington Republican Party. At the local level, there are some interesting tidbits and some status quo. Perhaps the biggest surprise is for the county commission seat held by longtime incumbent Al French. The veteran Republican is down 16 points to Democratic newcomer Robbie Catherine Anthony.
I'm running because I want to bring a sense of fiscal responsibility to the county. I'm a little exhausted with reading articles about the impending budget shortfall. And then when I also look at the condition of our roads, I can't figure out what's going on.
French's colleague, Republican Mary Cuny, is comfortably ahead of a fellow Republican, County Treasurer Rob Chase, for the other commission seat. Chase's treasurer seat will be filled either by Republican State Senator Michael Baumgartner or Democrat David Green. Baumgartner is up by nearly 9 points. Republican Leonard Christian is defeating fellow Republican Tom Conis for county assessor. Both hope to replace the incumbent, Republican Vicky Horton. Republican County Clerk Tim Fitzgerald is up 5 points on Democratic challenger Michael Kirk. A few other county incumbents, Auditor Vicky Dalton, Prosecutor Larry Haskell, and Sheriff Ozzie Knezovich were either unopposed or winning by huge margins. One other county-level race in which we reported, in Ponderay County, where Republican Commissioner Mike Maness won a 3-way race to advance to November. He'll face Newport Smelter opponent Cheryl Miller, who's running as an independent. At the legislative level, all of the incumbents in the 3rd, 4th, 7th, and 9th districts covering Spokane and a big chunk of eastern Washington won on Tuesday and have an advantage heading into November. In the 6th district covering much of South Spokane, the West Plains, and some of the North, it's an interesting jumble. Democrats are ahead in all 3 races, 1 for the Senate, 2 for the House. Jessa Lewis leads Republican Jeff Holey by a point for the Senate seat. Kay Murano is trying to wrest Representative Mike Volz's House seat from him. She leads by 5 points. And Democrat Dave Wilson is winning a 4-way race for Jeff Holey's House seat. It appears his opponent in November will be Republican Jenny Graham. And so we turn now to our legislative correspondent, Austin Jenkins, to give us the big picture.
This primary was definitely favorable to Democrats, unfavorable to Republicans. And what was really striking is that in nearly 24 state House and state Senate legislative races across the state, seats that are currently held by Republicans, the Republicans in those races were trailing the Democrats. So in that sense, there are perhaps signs that there could be something like a so-called blue wave coming in November. That said, it's also important to note that a primary has a small turnout, especially an August primary, and that it's really a snapshot in time. And the general election, while it may seem like November's right around the corner, that's also still several weeks and months away, and a lot can change between now and then.
I know a lot of people are wondering, you know, what's the effect of President Trump and his issues on a statewide level? What are your thoughts about that?
What's interesting is Democrats will absolutely say that this is the Trump effect in play, that the Republican brand is badly damaged. But now even Republicans are saying that clearly there are national factors at play here. And what they're saying is that their job in the next 90 days before the general election is to try to get voters focused on local issues, not what's happening nationally, when they're making decisions about who to vote for local and state races this coming November.
So both of the House and Senate are within a vote or two of flipping. But this was a pretty good session in terms of getting things done. How does if Democrats win more seats here, how does that affect what happens next year in terms of legislative agenda?
Democrats would love to have more seats because these very narrow majorities make it very hard to do anything that you can't get everybody lockstep to agree to. There's just no wiggle room, no margin for error. And the other thing is that the majority party always wants to be able to let some of its more vulnerable members not vote for potentially controversial issues that could come back to haunt them. And so it's nice to have the padding or the margin to say to a few of your more vulnerable or a few of your newer members, you don't need to take this tough vote. They don't have those margins right now. And the reality is that, you know, Democrats are not monolithic. There are a lot of issues that rural Democrats are not going to go along with urban Democrats on. And so to have a little bit more comfort zone and margin and bigger majorities is something that the majority certainly wants.
So there are three initiatives, it appears right now, that there will be three initiatives also on the November ballot, one dealing with gun regulations, one dealing with climate change. I don't remember what the third one is. How do you think that those will play out?
Well, we're already hearing based on these primary results and what's looking like a good year for Democrats shaping up that that could be very helpful to backers of this carbon pricing initiative. And so that's one to watch for, is just to see how who's turning out to vote affects the results of these initiatives. What's interesting about the gun measure is to look at what it doesn't do. It doesn't, for instance, ban so-called assault weapons. It doesn't restrict magazine capacity. It does some very targeted things like raising the age of purchase, requiring an expanded background check, requiring a waiting period, and also requiring quote-unquote safe storage of guns, and then criminal penalties if a gun gets into the hands of a child or somebody else and it's used for a crime, or if another, say, a child gets shot. That what that tells me is that the Alliance for Gun Responsibility that's behind this initiative is very carefully crafting these initiatives, and they've been successful in past years with the voters in mind. These are poll-tested ideas that they believe can pass a majority of the electorate. And so in that sense, I think that they're very confident about the ability to get this passed this year because they know they've got the polling on their side, and they've been very strategic about what's in there.
Austin Jenkins is the legislative correspondent for the Northwest News Network. Secretary of State Kim Wyman's office is responsible for preparing for the November election.
We're working really hard right now to get the general election voters pamphlet laid out, and we have a number of initiatives that will be on the ballot, and then we're trying to get all of the data and information for those to be set so that we can get that to the printer and get it out to voters. And then we're working with the counties on logic and accuracy tests, where we're testing their tabulation software to make sure that it's counting the way we'd expect it to. And, you know, we work with the counties on cybersecurity issues. I think that's one of our probably biggest focuses for this election and for the general election is making sure that we have our security in place and we're ready for any attempts made on the system.
Are you doing anything different this year in terms of security?
Oh, absolutely. You know, cybersecurity is not new to election officials. We've been really focusing on that for probably 15 to 20 years, ever since we went on the internet for election night results. But in the last 2 years, the focus has really amped up because one, Russians tried to hack into our system. They were not successful in 2016, but they certainly knocked on our door and tried to get in and weren't able to get past our firewall. So we've been working very closely with national groups like Homeland Security, the FBI, and others, trying to make sure that our systems are well tested and that we can do anything we can to beef up firewalls and monitoring sensors, to working with the counties to give them training so that their systems are also secure. And then we're working with a number of different partners, including the Washington National Guard, who's helping us with cybersecurity because they have a crack team of people that work for Microsoft and Amazon and some of those companies who serve in the Guard on the weekends. And they're helping us test our system and do things like tabletop exercises to help our counties be prepared for Election Day.
So are there any legal issues with any of the initiatives that where the petitions have been sent in? You've counted the signatures. Do you anticipate any changes in there due to legal issues?
Right now, we do have pending litigation on 1639, which is the gun initiative and placing restrictions on firearms. And we are in current litigation with that. We had two lawsuits filed after we verified the petition signatures. And so we're working through that in the court right now and trying to get everything in place for the voters pamphlet in the various scenarios that we anticipate the court could possibly rule on.
Yeah, you think that could hold up kind of the dissemination of those voters' guides statewide?
That's what we're working to prevent. We're trying to get the Attorney General's office and the Governor's office to give us the data that we need to provide explanations for the voters and financial impacts that these initiatives would have, and then also getting the pro and con committees for the initiatives, and that's a challenge, but we're working on it to try to make sure it's seamless for the voters.
So it sounds like it's going to be a pretty active next 3 months in terms of your work, but also in terms of a pretty good turnout maybe in November.
Oh, absolutely. I think the national interest in elections is going to certainly peak in November, and that will be high on people's radar. And we certainly have a few hot races here in Washington State that I think will help increase turnout. So we'll be very busy, and that's what we like.
Kim Wyman is Washington's Secretary of State. She's in charge of the state's elections. If you want to start your November general election homework, we have all of our stories and full candidate interviews, all 38 of them, on our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. Click on the Regional News tab and then on the Washington Primary Candidates link. What do Kellogg, Idaho, and Alexandra, New Zealand have in common? Smoky air, as it turns out.
Alexandra's had a persistent problem with air quality for decades. Does anybody else feel like on certain days when the air is cold or smoky, they can really feel it in their lungs? Do you feel that? Yeah, quite a few of you.
Ian Longley is a scientist at NIWA, which is New Zealand's version of our Environmental Protection Agency. 19 time zones to the west, Kellogg has had some of the same issues. EPA has judged the western half of northern Idaho's Silver Valley as not meeting federal clean air rules for at least a few days out of the year, usually in the winter when air inversions trap cold air and pollutants close to the surface. One of the culprits? The pollution created by wood stoves. Idaho's Department of Environmental Quality is taking a series of voluntary steps to improve the air quality. One is to encourage residents to swap their old wood stoves with cleaner burning versions. One of the other steps is education.
We believe that the future is communities that are involved in air quality management. So we really need to engage with communities, get them interested in the issue, get them aware that there's something that can be done.
In Alexandra, the government is teaching students about air quality. And because the world is getting smaller, it is now beginning a partnership with Idaho's DEQ, with the Kellogg School District, and the University of Montana's School of Public and Community Health Services. This week, Brett Taylor from the University of Montana shared a new curriculum about air quality with Kellogg teachers.
This one is a little bit more geared towards high school, but probably upper middle can handle it also. Has to do with what temperature inversions are and why does air quality deteriorate in the wintertime.
It gives kids a chance to actually do some science, because traditional science classes they're not science. You learn about somebody else's science. They're more like history classes. So science is a process. It's not something in a textbook. It's a process. All that stuff from a textbook came from somebody doing science, being curious about a question and figuring out a way to systematically attack the problem and come up with a logical answer to the question.
Ian Longley told Kellogg's teachers this week that Alexandra students in the 9 to 11 age range are given simple air quality monitors to install in and around their homes. They collect samples and learn how to interpret those samples.
We had a launch day in May, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. And we're planning a results day in September where really we're going to share with each other what we've actually learned from the process.
And then when the kids in New Zealand are done using the sensors, and remember it's winter there now, they'll pack them up and send them up to Kellogg, says Dan Smith from the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality's AirShed program in the West Silver Valley. Smith says the kids in Kellogg will install them at their houses during the winter months.
They'll be collecting air samples both inside the home as well as outside the home. It depends on what their hypothesis is. The kids are going to design their own science experiment. We're merely providing the monitors that allow them to collect the data that will work. So we have moisture meters if they want to find out what the effects of dry wood is in their wood stove. They'll be able to measure that with the moisture meter. We have CO monitors that we're giving, carbon monoxide monitors.
Kellogg High School teacher Mark Lama says he'll use this project in his technical math class.
I want them to see how the process of data modeling is omnipresent in their lives, whether they're aware of it or not, and how it's used to make decisions that affect them, both at the governmental level and how they even may use it to make individual decisions about how they spend their money.
He hopes enough students will find it useful to spur good discussions, both in his classroom and throughout the school. And in addition to the at-home sensors, Ian Longley says monitors will be deployed on poles throughout Kellogg to collect air samples.
And with Brett, he managed to deploy, 12 of them along the West Silver Valley for a trial. So this is from February through to April. So from our point of view, we were interested, you know, would they survive slightly colder temperatures that you have compared to us? Yes, they did.
And so those sensors will be deployed again in the West Silver Valley this winter to get an idea of whether measures taken to reduce wood smoke and other pollutants are actually working. The Tour de France bicycle race is a big deal in Europe, kind of like the Super Bowl is here. It's not such a big deal in America unless there's an American near the top. Lance Armstrong brought a lot of Tour de France excitement to the nation in the 90s, and so did the guy who preceded him as the first American to win the three-week race across France. That was Greg LeMond in 1986, and he won it three times. Former Washington Post correspondent Daniel Divise came through Spokane recently to talk about his new book about LeMond and LeMond's effect on cycling in America.
I shouldn't be laughing, but Greg got shot and nearly died in a hunting accident in April of 1987, just as he was about to go back and defend his title. And that was a little squib in the papers, and those of us who were following his career were sort of shocked. And then he vanished. And then a couple of years passed, and he sort of resurfaced and came back and was suddenly on top again, seemingly out of nowhere, and proceeded into what became, for a lot of people, the greatest and most gripping Tour de France of them all in 1989.
And then we saw him again during on TV during Lance Armstrong's departure, so to speak, where he was talking about his views that he thought Lance had been doping, if I remember all this right.
Yeah. No, you're right. What happened was when Lance burst onto the scene, immediately a lot of the European press and fans who were very seasoned followers of cycling, they knew that doping was rampant. They'd just come out of a big scandal. I think the Festina affair, it was called, in 98. And Lance won his first Tour in 99. And they were all, I think at that point, maybe assuming that the top cyclists might be doping until it was proven otherwise, if anything. So it was immediately a subject of debate among the cycling insiders. Now, Greg LeMond was a cycling insider. If you want to make a baseball comparison, he was like Hank Aaron, the retired great, and here was Barry Bonds, the new home run king. So everybody, of course, wanted to know, what does Hank Aaron think about Barry Bonds? And Greg was very careful in what he said. He heard all these rumors, that all the rumors the Europeans were hearing, but he was very careful. And finally, in 2001, I think he felt that he had no choice but to sort of say what was on the minds of a lot of people at the center of the sport, which is, maybe this is a fraud, you know. And let me be clear, it wasn't just Armstrong. I mean, if Lance were sitting here, he'd tell you almost all of his chief rivals at one point or another have either admitted doping or have been caught doping. And in Lance's mind, looking back, he was just trying to compete with them in every respect, right? But for Greg to make this statement was a huge deal. It rocked the cycling world. It put him on television and in the public eye in a way that he hadn't been for a long time. Here was, again, to carry on this analogy, Hank Aaron calling out Barry Bonds. It would be a big deal in baseball, and it sure was a big deal in cycling.
What, was LeMond ever the subject of rumors like that?
Le Mans era was a more innocent time. I sometimes call it the breaking away era. Those of us who followed cycling in the 70s and 80s, it was a wonderful time. Now, cycling has had dope in it since the beginning. Cyclists in these six-day bicycle races back at the turn of the century would take any kind of substance that would keep them on their feet or on their bikes because they were pedaling for, 144 hours straight. So they would take strychnine and cocaine and ether and anything, just anything that would keep them moving. So I think the sport was somewhat jaded toward that sort of behavior and drinking gentlemanly ales and that sort of stuff. By the time Greg comes around, there's a lot of amphetamines in cycling, just as I think there were in baseball and some other sports.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And there's corticosteroids during his era, which is, the cyclists now say that was like aspirin. It wasn't, none of these things could turn you into a champion if you were just a punter. But yeah, there was dope around. It wasn't really decisive. And so when people look back on the 80s, the first thing they're going to ask is not, was this guy doping? It's sort of irrelevant. But it has been widely, almost universally considered over the years that Greg was clean. Everybody seems to think he was clean. He certainly has said that he was clean. I spent many months pondering this question, and I found no credible evidence that he doped.
Was he eager that you were writing about him, or?
Imagine what it would be like if somebody who you didn't know contacted you out of the blue and said, I want to write a book about you.
Yeah.
Well, first you'd probably think they were a loony. And once, you know, you were convinced that there weren't a stalker or something, it would be a pretty big deal to try to deal. What am I supposed to do with this information? Well, I approached them, and I sort of established who I was and my credentials. And what I told them the first time I met with them, which was for a weekend in Minneapolis a few years ago, I assured them that if they would give me some help, which they agreed to do, that I would do my best to work around them as much as I could. They're busy, busy people. They're huge celebrities in their universe, their small universe of cycling. So they're always in huge demand. I said, I'll work around you guys. I will interview all of your friends, all of your loved ones. Just don't stop me. Don't thwart me, but allow me to do my job. And by the time I come back to you, which I think I met up with them again some months later, I'll have some questions, but I won't need to know your whole life story because I'll know most of it already. And so I worked around them in that spirit for a couple of years, and I got enough cooperation and help from them. And I would say it was enthusiastic that by the time the book was done, you know, Greg's voice and his hand, his influence was all over it. And he'd helped me correct things. He'd helped me set some stuff straight. The story of the horrifying sexual abuse to which he was subjected as a child, I guess, had never really been told correctly, so he walked me through it, you know, very painfully, and we set it straight.
Daniel Devizet is the author of The Comeback, Greg LeMond, the True King of American Cycling and a Legendary Tour de France. He read from his book recently in Spokane. Inland Journalist, Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can hear the program online at spokanepublicradio.org. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.